How did the elvish economy work in Middle-earth? Was it just some happy communes in Rivendell and Lothlorien, or was there more to it than that? Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. If you like theories, background, history and lore about The Lord of the Rings, A Song of Ice and Fire and The Witcher, then this is the channel for you. There's a subscribe button in the bottom right of your screen. It's quite easy reading The Lord of the Rings or watching the movies to view the elves of Middle-earth as living in a collection of some kind of idealised distributive commune. Everyone has everything they need and everyone is happy. It's easy to think that because the elves are presented as magical, ethereal beings operating on a different level to mere humans. But Tolkien cared about details. So how did the elf economy actually work? Was it all just magic and sharing, or was there more to it than that? And to avoid confusion, I'll mostly here be talking about the main Third Age elf communities in Lothlorien, Northern Mirkwood and Rivendell. We may well draw a few examples from previous ages, but that's not where our focus will be. Incidentally, when I say draw a few examples from previous ages, wonderfully, we actually have a short note from Tolkien entitled Note on Elvish Economy, which appears in The Nature of Middle-earth. It is mainly focused on earlier ages of the elves, but I'll obviously lean on it heavily when it's relevant. And of course, Valinor itself was very different. Even how farming worked was different there, and easier. As Tolkien wrote, "The grain, of some kind not native to Middle-earth, was self-sown, and only needed the gathering and the scattering of one-tenth, the tithe of Yavanna, of the seed on the field." With that said, we have to acknowledge up front that the elvish economy in Middle-earth still had a number of impressive inbuilt advantages over more human economies. First, obviously, elves are, to all intents and purposes, immortal. They do slowly age and grow weary, but when they do, they tend to account that as the right time to go to the Undying Lands. And although elf children mature physically slower than human children do, elves are considered to have achieved maturity at the age of about 100, and elf pregnancies last a bit longer than human ones, their low rates of reproduction mean that at any given moment in time, the vast majority of the elf population is of an economically productive age. In other words, there aren't very many children to look after, and still fewer, if any, aged elves to care for. Almost everyone can be an active member of society. Added to which, elves don't get sick. They can be injured or poisoned or wounded in battle, but they don't get infections or any of the other chronic conditions that humans suffer from. The economic impact here, again, is significant when you consider how much most modern states and individuals within those states spend on healthcare, care for the elderly and the young. The elves have hardly none of that to concern themselves with. Another, perhaps more unquantifiable, economic impact of elf immortality is the stability and wisdom it brings. Unlike human cultures, changing leader every few years or decades and changing policy even more often, the elves just keep going as they are. The leaders of the elves have remained unchanged for millennia by the time of the Lord of the Rings, and by and large, I think we would call that leadership wise. Galadriel, Elrond and Círdan, certainly. I have my reservations about Thranduil, but that's for another video. And finally, in terms of economic advantages or distinctives, the elves seem to have lived a broadly simple lifestyle. They are content with their lot, enjoying simple pleasures like singing and creative arts, lore and tending for the natural environment. This is good in that it means a happy, content population with limited demand for rare or hard-to-get products, but it also seems to have seriously dampened down innovation and economic development in some places. When the Noldor were back in Valinor, there were many advances. Feanor was at the forefront of this, his restless genius creating things like the Palantiri, long-distance communication devices, Feanorian lamps, lanterns that gave out continuous light without a power source, and much more. That innovative problem-solving invention is noticeably lacking in Third Age elves. Although they do have magic, we'll come back to that. So with all that in mind, how did the elf economy work? Well, it appears to have been managed both top-down and bottom-up. What I mean by that is that the elves clearly had leadership. There is a king or lord or lady in charge of each of the main settlements, and their word appears law, including telling people to do different tasks at different times, but many elves seem to have sorted themselves into the areas of expertise they specialise in. We hear of plenty of elves who are smiths and craftsmen. Celebrimbor in the Second Age is the primary example of this, but there are many others mentioned by name. Plus, by implication, those involved in construction, carpentry, tanning, clothmaking, and so on. None of this is at an industrial scale, though, just skilled artisans working their craft. And incidentally, other than warfare, which was mostly a male preserve, all other crafts seem to have been shared equally between male and female elves. Each did according to their skill and inclination, without sex or gender bias. Food production and agriculture is more curious, because Tolkien doesn't really mention this a lot in connection with the elves. But there are clearly some things they produced themselves, the Lembas bread and white mead in Lothlorien, for example, and most of the places the elves live don't appear suitable for anything approaching intensive farming, forests and caves and hidden valleys. We read of occasional fields and several gardens, but nothing large scale. I think there are a few answers to this, though. First, although elves do clearly love feasting, they have also developed foodstuffs that provide you with all the nutrition you need with only a few bites. Lembas, for example. So their need for agricultural land is much less. It's a matter of how much food they want. Second, woodland offers plentiful opportunities for hunting, foraging, and so on. We know the elves love to hunt and know herb lore. And thirdly, there is their magic. I said we would get back to that, although I'm sure Galadriel would at this point state that it isn't magic, it's just natural to them, which is fair enough, but compared to humans, hobbits, dwarves, etc., they do seem to be able to work with nature in a way that seems magical. Lothlorien, for example, seems unnaturally bountiful. A fruit tree grown there will produce lots of fruit. We get just a hint of this right at the end of the story. Galadriel gave Sam a gift of soil from her orchard. He went around the Shire and put grains of it wherever trees had been cut down or gardens damaged, and new trees grew quickly, so that later in that very same year, the fruit was so plentiful that young hobbits very nearly bathed in strawberries and cream, and later they sat on the lawns under the plum trees and ate, until they had made piles of stones like small pyramids. In the South Farthing, the vines were laden, and the yield of leaf was astonishing, and everywhere there was so much corn that at harvest every barn was stuffed. The North Farthing barley was so fine that the beer of the 1420 malt was long remembered and became a byword. It seems then that obtaining amazing food was not a problem in Lothlorien, and probably also in Rivendell. These two havens were not just well-run, but kept magically preserved and protected against the ravages of the outside world by the power of the rings of power possessed by Galadriel and Elrond. Galadriel implicitly admits this reliance on the power of the ring when saying to Frodo that if he destroys the One Ring, then our power is diminished, and Lothlorien will fade, and the tides of time will sweep it away. We must depart into the west, or dwindle to a rustic folk of dell and cave. Without the ring, Lothlorien would not be bountiful. As a complete aside, the third elven ring was worn by Gandalf, and it seems he may have used this power to help make bountiful and wonderful food and drink in a rather fun way at the Prancing Pony in Bree. When he hears that the hobbits are with Aragorn, he says this: "It's the best news I've had since Midsummer. It's worth a gold piece at the least. May your beer be laid under an enchantment of surpassing excellence for 7 years." Sure enough, when Gandalf and the hobbits return to the Prancing Pony after their adventures, Barliman notes that since then his beer has indeed been uncommonly good. But anyway, back to the elves. Whereas Lothlorien and Rivendell had rings of power to help them, Thranduil's realm in North Mirkwood did not, and they were stuck in some caves in a forest that started out being bounteous. Greenwood the Great, Mirkwood's original name, sounds like a lovely place to live, but by the end of the Third Age was getting darker and more corrupted by the year. I'm sure they managed some foraging, hunting and small-scale farming, but how did they make up the rest of what they needed? The answer, as we know from The Hobbit, is trade with the people of Laketown. From Laketown, the barrels were brought up the Forest River. Often they were just tied together like big rafts and poled or rowed up the stream. Sometimes they were loaded onto flat boats. When the barrels were empty, the elves cast them through the trapdoors, opened the water gate, and out the barrels floated onto the stream, bobbing along until they were carried by the current to a place far down the river. We read of wine, butter, and apples all being sent to the elves this way, and it wasn't just local trade. We're told that the wine came from Dorwinion, hundreds of miles away. We're not told what the elves traded back, so perhaps they just bought these goods. Indeed, the Master of Lake Town does seem pleased with the gold he gets from trade. There are a few comments about river tolls, presumably set by the elves, and Thranduil is very fast to gather his army and head off to Erebor to try to get some gold. In short, Thranduil's realm seems to operate on a very different economic model to Lothlorien and Rivendell. There, money doesn't seem to even be a concept, but for Thranduil, money is a necessary part of how he gets food and luxuries for his people. And he is, to put it tactfully, very happy to use the instruments of the state to secure additional money where he can, even by marching his army to what he thinks is an abandoned dragon horde that had belonged to someone else. To be fair to Thranduil, he does seem to soften his position once he finds that the dwarves are all still alive and his allies from Lake Town have a claim too. This economic model is not new for elves, actually. Back in the First Age, Doriath, where Thranduil's father came from and seemingly got some ideas from, had a similar model. Tolkien writes that the kingdom of Doriath was a woodland realm and had only a little open ground, except on its east border where they kept some small kine and sheep. Beyond the girdle of Melian eastward, there was much open land of wide extent. The Sindar, not under the rule of Thingol, dwelt and practised not only cattle-rearing and sheep-farming, but also grain-growing and other food crops, because both Doriath west and the dwarves east were ready to buy what they could. So the Woodland Realm and, before it, Doriath, both operated on the basis of growing what they could within the limitations of their land, but supplementing that by imports of essentials. So where does all this leave us? Thranduil's realm in northern Mirkwood was a trading nation-state led by an autocratic king. They were part of a burgeoning trading network in the north of the map of Middle-earth we know, with goods travelling up and down rivers, specialisation in production in different areas, and so on. The elves imported wine and butter, for example, production of which requires wide open spaces for cows and vines, spaces that didn't exist in Mirkwood. Income was generated by tolls, and probably also the sale of goods and services they were specialists in. Not that this was anything like a free market economy, other than the trading. It was very centrally run, with people being allocated jobs they didn't necessarily enjoy or excel at. The elves in charge of the barrels certainly didn't seem to be taking much pride in their job, and although they seemed to get by with feasts and fun, the Third Age was not good for them. They lost huge tracts of land in Mirkwood to the encroaching shadow, and although there were fewer elves than in earlier ages, the population of Upper Mirkwood was still greater than the other elven enclaves. Reading between the lines, the mention of squabbles over river tolls and Thranduil's rush to grab some of Smaug's hoard hint heavily that he needed that money for imports. North Mirkwood was no longer self-sufficient. Lothlorien and Rivendell are happier places, though. Harvests are good, populations are small, and the people are content, so the need for trade is minimal. They are both still led by strong leaders, who reserve the right to conscript people for military service, for example, but their economic systems seem, well, almost idyllic. There is no money that we can see, and no need for money. Everyone produces what their gifts allow, and they work within their environment for the blessing of all. From each according to their ability, and to each according to their need. No, not communism, Tolkien hated communism, but a commune where the environment provides for all, and the leader assures the security of the land. And fundamentally, this is not meant to be possible in the real world. It is made possible by magic. Without the Rings of Power, Rivendell and Lothlorien's economic systems would collapse, and they did. It's one of the most touching moments at the end of The Lord of the Rings, the realisation that Galadriel's most enduring legacy in Middle-earth after she left was that the Shire gained a taste of the bounty of Lothlorien for generations to come, and it is fitting that it was not sold to Sam, not traded for something, but given freely. Sam, out of all of the Fellowship, understood that relationship with nature that lay at the heart of the elves' economic system, and he bequeathed that to the Shire. If you'd like to see more Lord of the Rings videos, please click on the link appearing now on the left of your screen. Or to support this channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of your screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.